Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and this is the 10 Adventures podcast. Each week, we talk to real people about real adventures as they explore this incredible planet we all live on.
Imagine skiing over 1,400 kilometers across western Sweden, taking 93 days along the Vita Bandit route, which is known as the White Ribbon. This sounds incredible and is exactly what Paolo Peralta did this spring. Today, we're going to hear about this incredible feat and the challenges and rewards of such an incredible journey. Hi, Paolo. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Richard. Nice to be here.
So first off, this is a massive trip. What drew you to this route in particular?
So I've worked at a mountain station called Ritsem in northern Sweden. It's at the end of Sweden's longest dead-end road. It's a five-hour drive round trip to go get milk. There's a lot of people who are doing Vita and Gröna Bandet passing through there in the summer and the winter. So I've met quite a few people who've done this trip over the years, and lots of people who are out doing long trips in general, summer and winter, out in the more remote areas of Sweden. You know, week-long trips, two-week trips, month trips, I felt like I wanted to take on something a little bit bigger.
At this mountain station, that's a five-hour round trip to get milk. What do you do at the mountain station?
It's more of a hostel than a proper mountain station. I check people in and out of the rooms, clean toilets, stock shelves, sell people overpriced 3% beer, and answer questions about the area, ferries, buses, and stuff like that.
So when you went on this trip, did you know the whole, 1,400-kilometer area you were going through, or are you just really familiar with certain parts of it?
I've hiked Kungsleden in the summer, and then I know the area around Ritsem very well, so I know those parts fairly well. But the whole point of this trip is there's no defined route, so you just kind of take whichever way suits you best at the time. I knew where I would leave my depot boxes along the way, just because those are the only real places to go. But in terms of the actual route, I winged it as I went.
That's incredible. So envisioning this route, it's going up through kind of the mountainous areas of western Sweden. Is this a route where you're kind of like in the trees a lot, or is this a route where you're kind of just, surrounded by snow day in and day out?
It's pretty mixed. The first 2 weeks or so until you get to a town called Storlien, then it's quite a bit above the tree line, maybe about 50-50. But then once you get into the area of Sweden called Jämtland, and then from there for another about half the trip, so 700 kilometers, then it's a lot of forest, which gets old pretty quick. You're stuck on snowmobile trails in the forest. Once you get past Hemavan and you get on Kungsleden, after there, then it's maybe 80% or more above the tree line. So then you're back in life in the ping pong ball, just snow everywhere.
I couldn't imagine spending, weeks where you're mostly up in the Alpine, just, your eyes would get sore, you can't see in, depth perception. Any challenges you found in terms of spending so much time with just kind of in the ping pong ball, as you say?
Well, I wear good Jewelbo glasses and prescription. I'm blind as a bat otherwise. So I didn't have too much of a problem with in terms of snow blindness. But in terms of, walking, in terms of just not seeing certain features because of the snow, when my friend Paul and I were up in Hotagsfjällen in Jämtland, we had a really lovely day, first day of nice weather in ages, and we decided to take a shorter, steeper hill instead of going the long way around. We stopped, had a stack break, and then we took off our skis because the hill was so steep, maybe 30, 35 degree incline, maybe like 100 meters tall, if even that. Put the skis on the pulks, and then we took two steps forward, and we just walked into a maybe 75 degree wall of snow that had been two steps in front of us for the better part of 5-10 minutes, and we just hadn't seen it because the lighting just didn't let us. Kick toe holes in that, and just laughing hysterically the whole way up, hauled the sleds over this little ridge, and then the hill went back to its fairly easy incline.
That's a great example of just how these long ski traverses can be so different from a long bike tour or a through hike. Are there other aspects that are different? You mentioned you've done a lot of summer hiking and long distance hiking. Are there differences for skiing that you felt versus just, summer trips?
The biggest difference in winter for anyone who's spent any time out in the snow, especially way above the tree line, is that the weather determines everything. A bad storm in the summer, you're falling to the left and the right. But in the winter, if the weather's bad enough, you just have to sit and wait for days on end sometimes. I got pretty lucky this winter. I was only stuck inside from 36 hours at a stretch at the worst point. But I've been out previous years, and it's been 2-3 days stuck in a cabin waiting for the weather to lift. I mean, at the worst point here, I was stuck in a mountain station, and I had to bring my compass to go to the outhouse because you couldn't see 10 feet outside. The wind, the snow was flurrying so bad. So you don't really get that on summer hiking.
Yeah, definitely. What's avi risk? You know, again, here in the Rockies, everything's about trying to manage avi risk. What's it like in Sweden? Like in Canada, it would stress me out to be, you know, 93 days, a lot of it on your own, trying to deal with that. But is that a big concern for you?
For me, no. I use Nordic skis, so I can't really do very steep descents. I can't go slaloming down steep faces. So I have no, and I'm alone, so I have no avi gear, no probe, no transceivers, nothing like that. And mostly I just avoid avalanche terrain, so I don't have the risk. There were three occasions I had skied through old avalanches, but they were fairly small, and I was right at the edge of where they had been. And then two signs I'd saw over the course of the whole trip that said avalanche risk area. Overall, it's not really a problem. For some people who do this trip, we'll do it with Topptur, like whatever it's called in English.
Alpine touring skis?
Yeah, alpine. Some people will do this with alpine touring skis and kites, and then they'll stop and they'll take, you know, 2,000 meter peaks along the way and then ski back down. But I just went for distance. I'm definitely scared of avalanches, so I'll try to avoid that.
So I'm interested in your gear, in your skis specifically, because, you know, here in the Rockies, there's some like really nice kind of like gentle touring where you're kind of, it sounds like what you're doing in Sweden in terms of you're not going to avalanche terrain. It's more like just like exploring valleys or hills and whatnot. And I've done that on AT gear, and it's heavy and it's, you know, cumbersome. I think you were using kind of I assume there were metal edges on your cross-country skis, but you had fish scales and whatnot. And like, how was that different? Like, you know, what was it like using those types of skis, or have you even skied using alpine touring gear?
I've skied some cross country. I've skied some alpine touring, and it's much closer to cross country. You scissor up steep faces, you fly across flats, and up and then downhills are very enjoyable. But there's a limit to how steep of an angle you can take. They're pretty light. I think together the weight's like 1.8 kilos for both skis combined. And the boots weigh about the same, so it's really not that bad. And the boots have a little bit of flex to them compared to being locked in a coffin of alpine boots.
I like that terminology, because it definitely is. And especially with alpine touring, like if you're going up or down steep, they're actually really useful. But when you're going kind of flats or gentle, they're just a total pain. Another thing that really interests me is managing moisture is like a big pain, at least for me. And I go back into lodges every night where you can dry everything out. In your case, you were camping a lot. How did you manage like getting your boots dry, getting your base layers dry, stuff like that? Or did you just like push through kind of the uncomfortable mornings of putting on clammy gear?
Just suffering through it a little bit with some aspects, stuff like base layers. Yeah, then I just kind of deal with it. I run extremely hot, so I overheat very easy. So I'm usually the slowest person in the group because I constantly have to stop and strip down to just to the waist while everyone else is still wearing down jackets. Taking my gloves and on and off, switching from thick mittens to thin liner gloves, you know, venting my shirt, rolling up my sleeves. That's the primary moisture management. And then, frozen boots, I've had to deal with that on my first couple winter trips until I learned the proper way to take care of it. And now I use VBLs, so just a regular 5-liter freezer bag over each foot, a base layer sock, freezer bag, and then two thicker socks on top of that. And it keeps your boots from getting completely frozen. But I still happened to have a very unfortunate accident where I was crossing over a stream and I sunk up to the thighs in slush. So it filled both boots completely with water. And luckily it was a very warm day, maybe -2 or -3 Celsius. So just below freezing, and I decided it was just smarter to just ski through the day than stop and try to dry my stuff and just get cold feet and frozen boots. Then I had to spend the next 2 hours each night boiling water, putting it in Nalgene's, and then putting the Nalgene in the boots, dry the liners, also with the socks. I'd sleep with the socks over my chest to try to use body heat to try to get some of the moisture out. But the second night, I forgot to take the liners out of the boots, and they were completely frozen in. So I had planned to get an early start, but I had to pull the boots into the sleeping bag with me for 30, 45 minutes to thaw them out. So until the point I could pull out the frozen solid liner and slide in the extra pair of liners I carry these days.
Oh man, that's incredible. Now you were camping part of the way and you're staying in cabins or mountain stations. What was the breakdown? Like, was it mostly camping, or, you know, was it mostly staying in cabins?
I had 46 nights in the tent. I had 32 nights in mountain stations or mountain cabins or just like or emergency rooms. I had 6 nights in abandoned buildings, sheds, farms, bunkers in the European Space Agency test range. And I had 9 nights of cowboy camping towards the end.
What's cowboy camping?
You get, all right, time to stop for the day. Take the bedding bag off the sled, throw it down, open it up, take off your boots, get in the sleeping bag, and just no tent, no lean-to, no nothing. Just sleep on the ground.
Oh, cool. I haven't heard cowboy camping. I like that term. The hostels and cabins, I'm interested in that. Is that what you were staying in, is kind of like these rustic little cabins? Or are these like, I've seen some of the Swedish mountain stations where these are like really kind of plush hostel type environments that are pretty well fitted out. What were you staying in mostly?
A bit of both. I had some days I would spend in like the mountain stations or like you said, with electricity and Wi-Fi. Those are pretty rare. That's usually where I'd send my depot boxes, take a rest day, have a beer, get a burger, do some equipment maintenance. But then when I'm between those places, so maybe 10 to 15 days or more at a stretch, then I'd be staying in the STF emergency cabins, which is, it's like 2 wooden benches and a table in the middle. And there's 1 sack of wood for emergency use only. Or sometimes there's slightly nicer cabins that are manned during the summer. So it's, you know, 8 to 20 beds, wood stove. You have to go chop and saw your own wood and the woodshed next door. You better make sure you know where it is if there's a blizzard. It's a pretty diverse mix. And then some just abandoned buildings along the way, farms from the early 1900s.
So you did part of this with, you know, some friends joined you at points and part of it on your own. I would feel like doing a trip like this on your own, it could be stressful. It could be difficult. How did you find that time where you were just, you know, doing this on your own?
Yeah, my friend joined me after, I think, about 25 days or so. And I found the last, like, week or so before he arrived, I was really looking forward to having some company. At that point, it was the loneliness was kind of getting to me. I'm usually a fairly solitary person, but this was stretching it, just because I hadn't really met many other skiers and snowmobilers when they drive past, raise their hand and then keep driving on at 40, 50 miles an hour while I'm slogging along at 2. But once I had the company, it was really nice. And then after a while, it starts to wear on you again. Sharing a tent with someone for a month, even a 3-man tent with 2 people, but you've got giant sleeping bags and lots of equipment. You get on each other's nerves at some point. As sad as it was to see my friend head home, it was very nice to be back on my own. And on the last month or so of the trip, I was pretty much solitary. I met quite a few other skiers, but no one I shared the trip with after that.
What is like the trail culture? Are there lots of people doing extended trips, or most of them just up there for a day trip? I know there's only, like, I think you said there's only 20 people that were doing the whole route this last year, but like, how many other people are you going to see every day?
There were 22 people who signed up to do Vita Bandit and 12 who made it. One person managed to do a yo-yo, which is pretty impressive. First person to do that with dog sledding, so a little bit faster. I actually hit the timing pretty wrong. In the southern section from the start until Hemavan, where Kungsleden starts, then there's not really too many people out doing like more than day trip skiing or lots and lots of snowmobiles you see every day. Nearly every day, at least. But I got to Kungsleden just after the big touring season had finished, and due to Corona, it's slightly less than normal. But there, I was seeing, you know, 2-3 people a day sometimes. And then when you get closer to the mountain stations, then you're usually seeing quite a few more, maybe 10 to 20 people a day. But that's within, call it 10, 15, 20 kilometers of the station, people doing cross-country or alpine touring for the day. But once you get 50 kilometers away from the nearest road access, then you're pretty much on your own for the most part.
Being in Sweden in winter, I'm imagining there's, you know, some extreme cold. Being in spring, you probably get some nice weather. But how did you deal with the extreme cold? And was that a major issue for your trip?
I wish it had been an issue. This was a terrible winter. It was absolutely awful. I had 2 weeks of cold in the beginning. Temperatures, you know, pretty on average, minus 15, minus 20 Celsius, which is pretty comfortable for me. I can ski shirtless in minus 20 if I'm going uphill and it's hard. And then I had minus 32 was the coldest I had. And the next day, minus 27. But then the week after that, then it rained. And then it was the rest of March was just a terrible, terrible time. And pretty much the rest of the season, it was almost always warm. I barely ever used my down jacket except when I was sitting in the tent. Rain several times in March, I think 5 or 6 times. last 2 weeks of the trip, though, slight cold snap, maybe minus 15 at the coldest, so, but that's still pretty mild. So I was really disappointed that I didn't get a longer period of proper cold. So for me, not really an issue.
You know, you got weather that I'm sure a lot of people would love, but you know, you were craving the cold weather. And also, like, the rain can make the trip actually a total pain. Like, were you dealing with your skis sticking a ton and, you know, building up snow on the bases, or were you able to mitigate that with wax?
Oh no, it was an absolute hell. I have never had to deal with such awful conditions like I did in Jämtland. The worst day I've ever had in my outdoors career was I put in 9 hours of work for 7 kilometers with pretty much no elevation gain. It was mostly just flat. It was that day I went through the slush and got my boots filled with water. But then the rest of the day, there had been pouring rain 2 days before, and then 40 centimeters of fresh, loose snow on top of that. And then it was -2 or -3 degrees and sunny. So the skis and the sled would just go through this loose powder snow, hit the water and slush at the bottom, and then they would start to build up a big ramp of snow at the front, and the same on the skis, and would ride on top. And the snow, the sled is 53 centimeters wide. It was closer to 70 centimeters wide because of all the snow building up. It was truly awful. I'd have to stop every 500 meters and scrape everything loose. Not much progress that day.
That sounds like hell. I'm glad I haven't had to deal with that. I'm interested, you know, most people don't know about how you do these long distance traverses in terms of gear. Don't know what a pulk is. Can you maybe just explain how you know what you were using to carry all your gear and your setup?
You can use a backpack doing long distance skiing in the winter. You just have to go super minimal on equipment, or you have to be willing to carry a very heavy pack. But in Scandinavia, the typical thing is you can use a sled. You use the classic is wood with brass runners, but those are very heavy, 10, 12 kilos, sometimes even more. And then the more typical would be a fiberglass sled with plastic runners riveted to the bottom, and then some kind of canvas or polyester cover. I opted to spend a little bit more money with a sled from a company called Acapulco. And they do more expedition-oriented things for guys doing Greenland traverses, South Pole trips, North Pole trips. So it's Kevlar, carbon fiber, and weighs maybe like 1.5 kilos less. So it's a 5.2-kilo sled, yeah, and it's 150 centimeters long. So you can carry a lot of equipment. The capacity is like 350 liters. So with this, you can drag loads of 6 weeks of food and fuel in temperatures down to minus 40 with not too much issue.
I've found pulling a pulk, I can't get it. I'm not very good when I'm going uphill or downhill on a side hill. How do you pull a pulk so it's not just like super ungainly? Like you must have developed a technique that you can help me out so I can not screw this up again and again whenever I try and do it.
It's becoming more popular these days to pull with ropes, where you have ropes attached to the pulk and then a rope attached to the pulling harness you use, and then some kind of very heavy-duty elastic cord or like bungee cord in the middle, so it's not as jolting forward and back. And in the future, I might try that. I met Finn, who used that to great effect on flat ground and uphill. It's easily the best, most efficient way. The sled is constantly being pulled forward, but I use the pulling bars that Acapulco makes. Think like the letter H. You've got two long fiberglass rods and then aluminum strut in the middle that keeps them together. And then as you pull forward, the sled stays very stable. And when you're going uphill, it doesn't really make a difference. But going downhill, having these very solid struts means that the sled won't run you over if you brake too hard or take a bad turn or you fall. My technique is that once I start getting a decent speed and I don't have to use my poles anymore, I'll kind of lift the poles up and I'll toss them back so that they're making an X on top of the pulling bars. Wrist straps dangle on my wrists, and then it lets me grab the pulling bars, pull them forward so that I'm taking all the momentum of the sled and transferring it to my hips. And then as I do that, I can bend down, lean forward a little bit, and if I do hit a big bump or I have to brake really hard, then the sled behind me doesn't jam into the hip belt and knock me forward, which I used to do quite often. You don't crash when you slow down. You crash when the sled makes you slow down or makes you speed back up afterwards. So I found that technique worked really well over the winter, but in the future, I might want to try using ropes. It's lighter and it's more modular, but you don't get to enjoy the downhills as much, which is the big downside.
I'm going to try that next winter because, yeah, it's just such a pain. I want to be able to use it to go up and down, but it's great flat, but I keep struggling. You had a poke full of gear. Invariably in a big trip, gear changes. You realize some's working well, some's superfluous. Were there any great aha moments that, you know, as you did this, you're like, oh man, I totally didn't need some of this gear, or, oh, I totally misjudged this and I brought the wrong gear?
Honestly, I had my gear pretty well dialed in for the start. I started in early February, and you can get temps down to minus 40 then. So in terms of, negative 40 Celsius, which is totally reasonable in February, my kit was perfect for that. But after the first 2 weeks were over and the temperature started to rain and the temperatures stayed high, then I quickly decided, okay, cotton jacket with fur ruff, don't need that. Just quite a bit of my cold weather gear got sent home. Or extreme cold weather gear. And then later on into mid-April, early May, then the weather's usually good enough and there's enough small cabins. I felt comfortable setting home my Hilleberg Heron 3, which weighs like almost 4 kilos, and switching to my Cuban Fiber Duomid, which weighs a half kilo. So a long-term livability of the floorless pyramid shelter in the winter for me, not that great, but I decided the weight savings were worth it for such a short stretch at the end.
On this long, long trip, is there a part that, you know, when you think back, this is the crux of the trip, this is the hardest part, if people are thinking of doing this, that, you know, they have to be prepared for this?
That was that day with the slush, with the boots full of slush and hauling. I literally had bruises on my shoulders and hips because I wasn't pulling the sled forward. I was throwing myself forward, you know, trying to gain, you know, 5, 10, 20 centimeters at the time. And I'd every 500 meters stop, scrape the sled clear, go back, start pulling again. Just stop and start the entire day. I spent all day, luckily I had cell service that day, so I spent all day calling friends, trying to get some moral support, or just people to just joke around with me and make fun of my situation as I was out there. Yeah, either that or the day was just absolutely pouring rain the entire day, and I was just sitting on my sled eating Snickers in a $1 rain poncho I found. Luckily, I had my friend Paul with me that day, and that made the situation more bearable. So misery shared is misery halved. But yeah, bad snow and rain in winter, it's awful.
On the flip side, you know, there are some bad days, but like, is there a section or, you know, a part of this that's just, you know, epic or, you know, seared in your mind as just being kind of monumental?
Yeah, I got really lucky. I had so many days of bad weather. I had so many days of just awful snow conditions and just this terrible pulling. But I caught a real break between the town of Kvikkjokk and Ritsam, where I've worked before, and I knew I had good company waiting. I had 5 straight days of the best weather I've ever had out in the mountains, summer or winter. It was 5 days of no clouds, no wind, and barely any other people. The snow conditions were amazing. I could glide uphill. I had sent home my big, heavy 3-person tent, so the sled was so light. I didn't even have my second tent yet. I was planning on sleeping in cabins every night, but I ended up cowboy camping every single night. I just dig a slight pit for the sleeping bag. Sometimes I didn't bother with that. I had to put sunscreen on my face before I went to sleep because I'd wake up and the sun would be in my face, and I didn't want to get sunburned in my sleep. And there was one day there, I did 33 kilometers, and I did most of it in my underwear. It was the only underwear day of the entire trip. It was just gorgeous. And I got to this old chapel, a silver mine at the edge of Sodik, which is one of the Swedish mountains' nicest areas. Big 2,000-meter peaks, glaciers, deep valleys. You can see 30, 40, 50 kilometers. It's just an absolutely gorgeous place. And I'm just sitting in my sleeping bag eating a nice, my favorite meal of homemade chicken Thai. And as I'm sitting there, a fox comes up and just hangs out maybe, you know, 2 meters from me for about half an hour, looking around, scrounging for food. And it was just such a beautiful, cool ending to such a wonderful day of nice weather and just like these amazing vistas in the distance.
That sounds so, so cool. I'm interested, you know, doing this, you know, really long ski tour, you know, day 93 when you're finishing up, like what's the feeling? Do you feel a sense of euphoria? Is it just another day?
It was a bit of a very mixed feeling because I finished the trip in 89 days, but then I had to ski another 100 kilometers to the nearest road access in Sweden because of Corona. You can't go into Finland. It's like, you know, a 2-3 hour ski to the nearest bus stop, but I'm not allowed to take it. Finishing the trip, getting to the big cairn at the borders of Sweden and Sweden, Norway, and Finland was a very just euphoric moment, just screaming at the top of my lungs, yes, and just collapsing in a pile on there and just looking at the sky. And then sitting back up and having the beer I dragged 150 kilometers from the nearest store, I just thought, well, this was nice. Now I just have to, tomorrow I just have to put my skis back on and do another 100K, and then I'll be home free. But then reaching the cabin where I was waiting for my ride to pick me up at the end, then it was somehow a little bit let down, just a quiet, woo, made it. And then taking off the boots and sitting down and waiting for a day until they showed up.
And then getting back into society and like going from such a singular purpose every day, just, you know, I'm going to ski, you know, I'm going to go out and kind of that's my only focus to, you know, you're just moving. You mentioned you're just moving into an apartment. What's life like kind of getting off the skis now?
I've been back for a month. It feels more like a week. Trying to do the whole readjust to society thing. It's a work in progress, and it's probably going to take about as long as the entire trip did to undo the trip mentality. So I should be back in civilization properly in my head sometime around early September. Got to get a job to pay rent. Can't just live off my savings forever. And do some small summer trips out here and there to keep my sanity. But it's nice being back in the city with friends and family.
And so what's next? You've done this big ski traverse in Sweden. Are you already thinking of your next big trip?
Actually, initially, this trip was supposed to be the first of three. This was originally I was going to do Vita Bandet, Blåa Bandet, and Gröna Bandet all in 1 year. But I had some monetary troubles crop up last fall, so I didn't have the money to buy a sea kayak and support the better part of 10 months hiking, skiing, and kayaking. Hopefully that will be the next big thing, would be one of those three. So it would be doing the same trip I did now, but in summer. So with like a very 5-6 kilo base weight, doing 1,500 kilometers, doing more detours, climbing more peaks along the way. And then after that, doing the big sea kayaking trip around the entire coast of Sweden. After those two are done, doing all three of these big trips all together in 1 year, and just do like a full circuit of Sweden through the seasons.
That sounds incredible. Has that been done before? Is that like a common?
It's been done a couple of times. Won't be the first.
That seems like an incredible way to spend a year. This has been so great, Paula, just to hear about this trip, to hear about this way to explore in the winter. I know so many people focus on summer and, you know, like me, think about winter as a place that's, you know, avalanche danger and very concerning. But there is a different way to do it in Sweden, and you've done it. So congratulations on completing this. And thanks for sharing this on the podcast.
Sure, Richard. It's always lovely to try to get other people out there. My first winter trip, I kind of shed a tear and hugged the teacher who brought us out there because I realized this is the proper kind of adventure I've been waiting for my whole life. And for anyone listening, I really recommend go out there. You'll be cold. You'll be tired. You'll probably be cold. You'll bring too much stuff. You'll bring too little stuff. But just go out there and just keep at it until you feel you can sit down the snow and just properly forget where you are and just enjoy the scenery. It's worth every minute.
I couldn't agree more. And if anyone wants to follow Paolo, you can find him on Instagram at Expat Vagabond Adventures. And there's great photos, and you can ask him some questions if you're thinking about a similar trip as this. Thanks a lot, Paolo. Cheerio.
Cheers, Richard. Have a lovely day. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. If you liked it, why not give us a review? Better yet, subscribe and get inspired again and again. Also, if you want to find your own adventures, why not check out 10adventures.com, where you can use our free resources to plan your own trip or book a tour in over 60 countries and make your own epic memories on your next adventure.